It was barely 8:30 when we came out, but despite the early hour, the shops were mostly shuttered and the streets were all but deserted. B is a stroller, as I am. He seemed to be going nowhere in particular, and I was glad to tag along. He said, "I'm sure you're beginning to see why it isn't possible for me to carry mass audiences of listeners along in this direction." "Yes, I see that, but I'm not sure I see the direction." "Remember that we're working on a mosaic, not a narrative or a syllogism. After this conversation, you still won't have a conclusion, but you should have a more complete understanding of everything you've ever heard me say."
"Yes, that's true. The figure in the mosaic is still a little vague, but it's not as vague as it was 2 hours ago."
"A while ago you said that the way I was talking, it's a wonder that our cultural revolution ever took place. It really is a wonder. It wasn't destiny. It wasn't divinely ordained from the foundation of the universe. It wasn't something that was just inevitably going to happen. It hadn't happened in 200,000 years of people as smart as we are. It might not have happened in another 200,000 years, or in another million. It was a quirk, a fluke. Combine one never-before-seen cultural element with a second never-before-seen element, add a third just as odd, and you come up with a cultural monster that is literally devouring the world, and will end by devouring itself if it isn't stopped." We came to a stop at an odd sign reading Meyer Uber Bleibselin, whatever that was. B looked over the huge gray steel shutter as if in hopes of locating a button he could press to make it go away. When he didn't find it, he began unceremoniously pounding on it with his fist. After a minute, a window above shot up, and the ghost of Christmas Past leaned out to ask in German what the hell we were doing. This, I soon learned, was Gustl Meyer. Meyer and B yelled at each other for a bit, in English and German. Then the window was slammed shut. B gave me a smiling nod, as if to assure me that everything was going really well. Then, a couple of minutes later, the shutter clattered up, and we were admitted to the dim interior of Meyer's shop, which was stocked exclusively with the cast-offs and leftovers, Uber Bleibselin, of museums devoted to every sort of thing except art, military history, political history, natural history, science, technology, and industry. As soon as we crossed the threshold, B's eyes flashed with a kind of electric joy like a 5-year-old in a toy shop, and I began to realize he was a man with the heart of a completely lunatic collector of curios. He was enchanted by a working miniature of an early safety elevator, by a life-size wax Neanderthaler who sat cross-legged on the floor, absorbed in some handwork that was no longer in his hands, by an exquisite cutaway scale model of a copper mine, by a hideous and wholly improbable stuffed dodo that Meyer claimed had been made from an actual skin, by a battered one-man submarine of the Napoleonic era, by a transparent talking head that described the operation of the brain in Dutch, while pinpoint lights within indicated the areas under discussion. There were crates of ore samples, piles of tarnished brass instruments, boxes of disintegrating scrolls, racks of entomological specimens, tubs of fossils of every kind. And it was at one of these that B finally paused to begin rummaging in a serious way. He took out and examined trilobites, crinoids, and things I assumed were dinosaur eggs, teeth, and claws. Finally, he stopped at a donut-sized object rather like the shell of a chambered nautilus, except that it was corrugated like the curling horn of a mountain sheep. "An ammonite," B said. "Cephalopod. Same class as the Nautilus." After paying for it, he dropped it into my hand, saying, "Been extinct for about 65 million years. "What am I supposed to do with it?" "Put it in your pocket. We'll get around to it." We stopped at a nondescript Gasthaus for dinner. "I have to go back to the first piece I tried to put in place tonight," B said. "I know it's not set in solidly." "Okay." "Last night, in the theater, I talked about changing minds. I said that if the world is saved, it will be saved by people with changed minds. Not by programs, but by people with changed minds.
I remember.
It's difficult for people to credit this notion, because they don't see that what we have here, every bit of it, all the triumph and glory and catastrophe of it, is the work of people with changed minds.
I don't see it myself.
I know. That's why we're coming back to it. Let's make sure we're agreed on basic facts. The mind change I'm looking at occurred about 10,000 years ago, in what has been called the Fertile Crescent, an area between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, now encompassed by Iraq. It was the inhabitants of this area 10,000 years ago who laid the foundations of what is now our global culture. Is this what you understand?
Yes.
Good. Now, I'm sure you realize that the human race didn't originate in the Fertile Crescent. The evidence we have right now indicates pretty conclusively that the human race originated in Africa, and then very slowly spread into every part of the world, the Near East, the Far East, Europe, ultimately reaching the most distant regions, places like the Americas, Australia, and New Guinea, about 30,000 or 40,000 years ago. The Near East, being next door to Africa, has been inhabited by modern humans for an immensely long time, 100,000 years or more. This includes the area of the Fertile Crescent. You see the point I'm making here?
No, not really.
The area we're looking at, the Fertile Crescent, was inhabited by modern humans for something like 100,000 years before our agricultural revolution began.
Okay, I think I understood that already.
I'm pointing out that the revolution we're looking at occurred among people who had been living there for tens of thousands of years. People were living there, and a revolution occurred. The revolution wasn't a meteorological event. It wasn't an earthquake or a volcanic eruption. It was something that happened among people. About 10,000 years ago, people who had been living in the Fertile Crescent for tens of thousands of years began to live a new way, the way I've called the Taker way.
I see that.
They didn't begin to live a new way because they were starving, because, as I said, starving people don't invent lifestyles any more than people falling out of airplanes invent parachutes. And their new way to live wasn't adopted because it was so pleasant that it was just an inevitable next step forward. What these founders of our culture fundamentally invented for us was the notion of work. They developed a hard way to live, the hardest way to live ever found on this planet.
But it gave them some other things beside a hard life.
Exactly. Now you're running with me, Jared. Now you're beginning to see why I say that these people represent changed minds. They didn't think like the Gabusi or the Cheyenne or the Alawa or the Ihalmiyat or the Mi'kmaq or the Bushmen or any other of thousands of peoples I could name. What they were doing didn't make sense to their neighbors, but it didn't have to. What they were doing wouldn't have made sense to their great-great-great-grandparents, but again, it didn't have to. What they were doing made perfect sense to them, the way that what the Gabusi do makes perfect sense to them. What they were doing made perfect sense to them because they saw things differently. Differently from the way their ancestors saw them, and differently from the way their neighbors saw them. Do you see now why I say these people represent changed minds?
I think so.
Because we share that mind change, we look at what they did and say, well, of course, this makes sense. What could be more obvious? This was bound to happen. Humans were meant to live as takers. Because we share their mindset, their revolution makes perfect sense to us. To us, it looks logical and inevitable. The way eating sorcerers seems logical and inevitable to the Gabusi.
Yes, I see.
We know what ethnic group these people belong to. Evidently, they were Caucasians. But there's no reason at all to suppose that every Caucasian people took part in this revolution. The Gabusi and their neighbors, the Kubor, the Bedamini,
The Oibe, the Honibo, and the Samo all belong to the same ethnic group, but they certainly don't have a common culture. Are you following me?
I think so.
We'll never know what the people of the revolution called themselves, but let's make up a name for them. Let's call them the Tak. This will link them to the way I've called the Taker way. The Tak didn't become agriculturalists because they were hungry, or because they liked hard work better than loafing. Quite on your own, you grasped the key fact that they got something out of their toilsome life that compensated them for it. Why did they become agriculturalists? What did totalitarian agriculture give them that foraging didn't give their neighbors and their ancestors?
You've already showed me this. Totalitarian agriculture gave them power.
That's right. Their revolution wasn't about food. It was about power. That's still what it's about.
Yes, I can see that.
Someone once asked me how I could go on maintaining that the human race isn't flawed if it's so enamored of power. The Tak succumbed to a lust for power. Isn't that a flaw? All their cultural descendants succumbed to a lust for power. Isn't that a flaw? I told him about a famous psychological experiment of the late 1950s. An electrode was implanted in the pleasure center of a monkey's brain. Pushing a button on a small control box delivered an electric pulse to the electrode, giving the monkey a tremendous jolt of sheer whole-body pleasure. They gave the box to the monkey, who of course had no idea what it was, but by accident eventually pushed the button, giving itself this tremendous jolt of pleasure. It didn't take many more repetitions for the monkey to catch on to the connection between the button and the pleasure. And once this happened, it just sat there, hour after hour, pushing the button and giving itself jolts of pleasure. It passed up food. It passed up sex. If they hadn't eventually taken the box away, the monkey would have sat there and literally pleasured itself to death. Here is the question I asked back to my questioner. Was there something wrong with this monkey? Was the monkey flawed? What do you think, Jared?
I would say no, the monkey wasn't flawed.
I'd say the same. Nor were the Tak flawed. Pushing the button of totalitarian agriculture gave them a tremendous jolt of power. It gave the same jolt of power to the people of China and to the people of Europe. It gives us the same jolt of power today. And just like the monkey, no one wants to quit pushing that button. And we're in serious danger of pleasuring ourselves to death with unending jolts of power.
I see what you're saying. This is what you mean when you say that if the world is saved, it will be saved by people with changed minds. People with unchanged minds will say, let's minimize the effects of pushing the button. People with changed minds will say, let's throw the box away.
B nodded. As soon as the people of our culture decide to throw away the box, things will begin to change dramatically. Our food came at this point, and we both fell silent to give it our attention. Finally, B said, I've told you the Tak seemed like lunatics to their neighbors, just as the Gibusi seemed like lunatics to us. You find that hard to believe?
Yes, I do, but I suppose the Gibusi find it equally hard to believe that they seem like lunatics to us.
Just so. The Tak seem perfectly reasonable and ordinary to us because we're their cultural descendants. We have the same worldview they had.
I understand. But even so, we can't actually know what the Tak's neighbors thought of them.
In this case, by a great fluke of history, we can know what at least one of their neighbors thought of them. Or rather, we do know, because we have their version of what happened. Again, we know what ethnic group these neighbors belong to, but not what they call themselves. Let's call them the Zeugen. In other words, the witnesses. In terms of lifestyle, the Zeugen were rather like the Maasai of East Africa. Do you know the Maasai?
Oh, I've heard of them. They're nomadic herders, aren't they?
That's right. The Zeugen, too, were nomadic herders. And when they looked at the Tak revolution, they didn't see a technological advance or anything remotely like a technological advance. What they saw was an overturning of the order of the universe.
They saw, as you have, that totalitarian agriculture isn't about food. It's about power. Power over who lives and who dies in the world. Is it clear why they would see it that way?
Talk about it some.
The easiest way to see it is by example. According to totalitarian agriculture, cows may live, but wolves must die. According to totalitarian agriculture, chickens may live, but foxes must die. According to totalitarian agriculture, wheat may live, but chinch bugs must die. Anything we eat may live, but anything that eats our food must die. And not merely on an ad hoc basis. Our posture is not, if a coyote attacks my herd, I'll kill it. Our posture is, let's wipe coyotes off the face of the earth. When it came to wolves and cows, we said, let the wolves be destroyed. And the wolves were destroyed. And we said, let there be cows by the billion. And there were cows by the billion.
Okay, I get it.
Who ordinarily wields this power?
What do you mean?
Look at it from the point of view of some nomadic herders of 10,000 years ago. Who decides who lives and dies on this planet?
The gods.
Of course. Now, the way that Zeugen imagined it, the gods have a special knowledge that enables them to rule the world. This knowledge includes the knowledge of who should live and who should die, but it embraces much more than that. This is the general knowledge the gods employ in every choice they make. What the Zeugen perceived is this, that every choice the gods make is good for one creature, but evil for another. And if you think about it, it really can't be otherwise. If the quail goes out to hunt and the gods send it a grasshopper, then this is good for the quail, but evil for the grasshopper. And if the fox goes out to hunt and the gods send it a quail, then this is good for the fox, but evil for the quail. And vice versa, of course. If the fox goes out to hunt and the gods withhold the quail, then this is good for the quail, but evil for the fox. You see what I mean?
Of course.
When the Zeugen saw what the Tok were up to, they said to themselves, these people have eaten at the gods' own tree of wisdom, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
I said, yipes, and sat there frozen for 3 minutes while I tried to work out all the implications of this radical new interpretation of the story of the fall. When at last I shook my head and gave up, B went on.
I felt I had to bring this out in order to drive home the point I've been trying to make about this revolution. Even the authors of the story in Genesis described it as a matter of changed minds. What they saw being born in their neighbors was not a new lifestyle, but a new mindset. A mindset that made us out to be as wise as the gods, that made the world out to be a piece of human property, that gave us the power of life and death over the world. They thought this new mindset would be the death of Adam. And events are proving them right. I threw down my napkin and said, I'm full up. B gave me a look of frowning puzzlement.
That's all I can take for tonight, I told him.
But it's early.
I know, and I'm sorry, but I can't take in anymore. And I've got to figure out how this is going to be transmitted to Father Lulfer. I can't just send him a transcript of the tape. If he got the idea that I was becoming the sorcerer's apprentice, he'd pull me out in an instant.
B shrugged. I agree. We can't risk that. We arranged to meet for dinner the next day. When I got back to my room, I resisted the temptation offered by the bed. I wanted to get a fax off to Father Lulfra by 3 or 4 in the morning, so as to maintain the pattern I'd established in previous days. It was my thought to translate my conversation with B into a series of vignettes in the style of the Gospels. A man came up to Jesus and said, or Jesus was met by a large crowd, one of whom shouted, I'm not sure I produced anything very convincing. It's 5 a.m., and I feel wired as tight as a harpsichord. I hope a slug of whiskey will let me sleep. Tuesday, May 21, Radina. The phone rang at 9,
and I crawled up out of a stupor miles deep to answer it. It was Sheeran, explaining something far too intricate for me to comprehend on less than 4 hours of sleep. I asked her to go over it again slowly, and finally got it straight. There was one speaking engagement B had been unable to talk his way out of, and it was today in Stuttgart. In order to reach it on time, we would have to board a train at 11, and I was welcome to come with them to Stuttgart or to stay in Radenau. It was up to me. I told her I'd meet them at the Bahnhof at 10:50. There was something on my mind that I needed to explore on paper, so I took a notebook down to the dining room with me and wrote as follows. There is only one degree of having faith, but there are 50 degrees of losing it. I think I know one priest who has faith in that one degree that deserves the name of faith. All the rest, including me, are at one of those 50 degrees of losing it. Most of my parishioners would probably consider this a shocking admission, but I don't think it is. Of course, there are priests who have gone beyond the 50 degrees and have walked away from the ministry. Everyone knows that, and I've known half a dozen of them myself. But the rest of us are still hanging on, by knees and elbows and fingertips and eyelashes and teeth and fingernails. This is actually reassuring, I think, because it shows that none of us wants to lose our faith or wants to think of himself as having lost it. Admittedly, this is partly just cowardice. We know that once our faith is gone, the religious life will become utterly intolerable, and we'll have to move on, out into an unknown world. But it's also partly because we have enough faith to want to go on having faith. When that amount of faith is gone, however, then it's all gone, and you're at the 51st degree. You're out. You're finished. I figure I'm at something like the 34th degree. When I was 15, I was at the one degree that means faith. When I entered the seminary, I was at the third degree of losing faith. At my ordination, I was at the 12th degree. When I walked into Father Lulfra's office 3 weeks ago, I was at the 25th. The fact that I'm at the 34th now probably sounds pretty bad, but actually it isn't. I was afraid, when I sat down here to do this soul-searching, that I was going to turn out to be at some really scary degree, like 47. I mean, when you're at 47, you're really at the precipice. Three more degrees, and over you go. The party of travelers to Stuttgart consisted of B, Sheeran, Michael, and me. As we shook hands, Michael, for the first time, gave me a surname by which to know him. Though I can only guess at its spelling, it sounded like Dershinsky. Sheeran was businesslike and neutral. B seemed gloomy and preoccupied. No one was in a conversational mood, except possibly Michael, who kept giving me friendly nods and winks, but otherwise seemed to be reining in his good mood out of deference to Sheeran and B. After we were underway for 10 minutes, I piped up to ask what the speaking engagement was. No one seemed keen to tell me. Finally, B explained that it had been organized by a man and a woman at the university there who knew and wanted to promote B's views on population. I said, "You don't seem wildly enthusiastic about it." "My views on this subject always generate a lot of rage."
"Rage among whom? The Catholics?"
"No, not at all. The Marxists."
"Why the Marxists?"
He shrugged and turned his gaze out the window.
Michael and Sheeran each gave me a little shake of the head to warn me off.
In Hamburg, we changed trains to something faster and slightly less austere, but the atmosphere remained bleak and didn't improve when we broke out the box lunches Michael had picked up for us at the Hamburg station. In Stuttgart, we were met at the station by our hosts, a middle-aged couple with a car into which five might conceivably squeeze, but not six by any means short of dismemberment. The problem was easily solved. Michael and I followed in a taxi. This ride gave me a new insight into him. He'd not been silent in the train out of deference to B and Sheeran. He'd been silent out of sheer, desperate shyness, even more acutely projected now when he might have talked as much as he liked. I made a couple of efforts to draw him out, but soon understood that he really preferred to remain in the background and never step forward into the light. The taxi deposited us in front of a vast neo-Gothic prison of a school, and we were led upstairs to a classroom that would have depressed a barrel full of monkeys. My heart sank as I saw it. Some 20 silent spectators were scattered through the room, half of them with the air of actors psyching themselves up to read for the role of Cassius in Julius Caesar. B, Sheeran, and the host couple were at the front chatting, or trying to give the impression of chatting. Michael and I shuffled off to the back. A few minutes later, Sheeran took a seat in the front row, and B was introduced at length and in German. It was B's longest presentation to date. I wasn't prepared for what I heard. Not that I ever was when it came to B. This material was extraordinary, unlike anything I'd ever heard or read on the subject. When he was finished, about 7 people applauded, 2 of them being our hosts, and 3 of them being Sheeran, Michael, and me. Looking drained to the point of collapse, B began fielding questions, or rather, disquisitions and rebuttals, all in German. Michael leaned in my direction to explain that by declining to use English, which they obviously understood, they were demonstrating their contempt for B's views. Before answering them, B summarized their questions in English, presumably for my benefit. As far as I could understand them, they simply denied everything B had said. An interesting approach, I thought. At the end of it, or when he got tired of it, B thanked his listeners and stepped away in the midst of a bemused silence. Evidently, some sort of polite social follow-up had been planned for us, but we skipped it in order to catch a train back to Hamburg. As luck would have it, this late-night train was of the cozy old-fashioned sort, with separate compartments. Once we were settled in, B said with a growl, "Remind me never to do this again." "I reminded you before you agreed to go in the first place," Sheeran noted dryly. "You didn't do it forcefully enough." Michael cleared his throat and said, "You never know when you might have planted a seed," and then turned an amazing shade of scarlet. "It's kind of you to say that, Michael," B said gently. "But that was mighty hard ground."
"It was indeed."
"Where did we leave off last night?" B asked me a few minutes later. I thought for a bit and said,
"You'd just made this point, that what the authors of the story of the fall saw in our agricultural revolution was not a new technology, but a new worldview that makes us out to be as wise as the gods, wise enough to wield the power of life and death over the world." B nodded.
"I'm glad we got that far, but that's the easy part of what we have to accomplish."
"Why is that?"
"It's easy for us to understand what those first farmers had in mind when they settled down to live in villages. It's easy for us to understand what the Bronze Age traders had in mind as they caravaned their wares over hundreds of miles between Thebes and Heracleopolis, and Damascus and Assur and Ur. It's easy for us to understand what the empire builders of Akkad and Sumer had in mind, what the builders of the Great Wall of China had in mind, what the builders of the colossal pyramids of Egypt had in mind. I trust you see what I mean. I could obviously go on piling up examples for hours."
"I see what you mean."
"We understand what they had in mind because they were doing what we would do in their place. They were our cultural kin. These were people who saw the world as we see it, and who saw man's place in the world as we see it."
"I understand.
But when we look back beyond our agricultural revolution into the human past, we no longer understand what people had in mind. We don't understand what they had in mind as they lived through tens of thousands of years without trade and commerce, without empires or kingdoms or even villages, without accomplishments of any kind."
"Well, that's very true. I'd say it's our impression that they didn't have anything in mind. It's not that we don't understand it, it's that there was nothing there to be understood."
"This is, of course, another result of the great forgetting. We've forgotten what people had in mind before our revolution."
"I guess I still don't get it. Why is it important to know what people had in mind before our agricultural revolution?"
Besides, sounding monumentally defeated by my mental sluggishness. I looked around at the others, but they were keeping their eyes and their thoughts to themselves. We were at this moment just pulling into Frankfurt. B and I were sitting across from each other at the window side of the car, and with nothing better to do, I scanned the faces of passengers waiting to board, and was surprised to see a familiar one. The train had glided past him by the time I remembered who it was. It was Herr Reichmann, the elderly gentleman who had advised me to drop Charles Adderley in favor of a person scheduled to speak at Der Bau, who of course turned out to be B. I was thinking vaguely of the possibility of tracking Herr Reichmann down on the train to introduce him to B, when B picked up where we left off. "You say you don't know why it's important to know what people had in mind before our agricultural revolution." "That's right. I wish this weren't the case, but it is. I understand what we've had in mind here for the past 10,000 years. I can see what idea motivated us, because I can see what we accomplished. But I can't see what idea motivated our ancestors, because I can't see what they accomplished. As far as I can see, they didn't accomplish anything. Show me what they accomplished, then maybe I can understand what they had in mind." For about 3 minutes, I thought perhaps I'd finally presented this man with a gulf of ignorance and incomprehension too great even for him to cross. But finally, he went on. "According to our cultural mythology, the human race was born just a few thousand years ago, and it came into being with the human lifestyle already wired into it. According to our cultural mythology, humans were born knowing how to live like human. Do you understand this?"
"You mean, do I understand that this is our cultural mythology?"
"Yes, I do." "You understand, therefore, that it didn't actually happen this way. Homo habilis did not, in fact, 3 million years ago, awaken to a lifestyle that we would today recognize as human. Our ancestors didn't go to sleep one night as Australopithecines and wake up the next morning as a human community."
"I understand."
"This is the work that occupied our ancestors for 3 million years, Jared. The development of a human lifestyle. The development of everything that is meant by human culture. This is what our ancestors accomplished before we came along to build transistors and golf balls. They learned how to live like humans, how to live well, how to have a great life."
"And is there an idea behind that?"
"I think you'll find there is. In any case, that's the challenge that confronts me, Jared, to reveal to you this idea. Right now, I know it seems to you that all this beauty and catastrophe of ours was bound to happen. It was somehow in the very fabric of humanity to become what we've become, in the way that it's in the very fabric of the caterpillar to become a butterfly."
"Yes, that is the way it seems to me."
"Someday, if I succeed, you'll see that humanity was no more bound to become us than it was bound to become Gibbousi. The people of our culture don't represent the final stage of human development any more than the Gibbousi do."
"I hope you do succeed in that, I really do."
He stood up and grabbed the luggage rack overhead to steady himself. "Time for a walk," he said, and headed for the door. I sat and looked at Michael and Sheeran for a while, inviting conversation. Since that wasn't forthcoming, I pulled out my notebook and brought it up to date. After an hour, Sheeran didn't agree with my assessment that B had been gone a long time. She figured he'd just run into someone he knew, and Michael characteristically didn't think it was his place to have an opinion, so I went looking on my own. The compartments were divided from the corridors by partitions with glass inserts, so it was easy enough to see who was where, and B wasn't anywhere in the front part of the train. A few compartments were empty and dark, and I saw no reason to check these until I ran out of other places to check. I realized he was almost as short on sleep as I was, and after his difficult evening in Stuttgart, he might well decide to stretch out on an empty seat for a nap. When I finally found him, I thought I was right, but I was wrong. He was stretched out on an empty seat, all right, but he wasn't asleep. He was dead. Eyes open, with a bullet hole in his left temple. Maybe someday I'll write down what I went through in that minute, but not now. I think I came close to doing what used to be meant by losing your mind before those words just became another cliched synonym for going crazy. I knew I had to throw the emergency switch and stop the train, as little as I wanted to. There didn't seem to be any choice about that, though, of course, lots of passengers thought differently. It was a mess, of course, a nightmare. At first, I thought I'd be executed on the spot. Eventually, the conductor understood about the corpse. Eventually, Michael arrived and took over as interpreter. Eventually, some police arrived. It seemed like hours later. Then waves of police arrived, each with the same question. I was handcuffed twice, nearly three times. The train was eventually moved on into Hanover, just a few miles ahead. The night went on and on and on. Finally, Michael and Sheeran convinced the police that I was a very improbable murderer, and they let me go after confiscating my passport. By this time, it was dawn. Michael found a cabbie willing to drive us to Rottenau, and we got out of that place. I slept till 8 p.m., went downstairs for some dinner, and faxed Father Lufre a note explaining what had happened. One police official with a good command of English had told me to call if I recollected anything that wasn't in my statement. I called him and told him about seeing Herr Reichmann on the train platform at Frankfurt.
How do you know that he wasn't meeting someone on the train?
I don't, but people who are meeting someone don't come forward the way he did. They stand back so they can see people getting off down the whole length of the train.
That's well observed. So let's say he got on the train. You think he had a reason to want to harm your friend?
No, not at all.
Then what's the point?
You said to call if I remembered anything. That's what I'm doing.
Good. I appreciate that. By the way, the tests on your hands were negative for traces of gunpowder.
That's news to you, but not to me. I already knew there was no gunpowder on my hands. Can I get my passport back?
In a day or two. We just want to be able to talk to you if we need to.
We said goodbye. I felt half dead myself. I didn't want to think. I didn't want to remember. I didn't want to do anything. I got out the bottle of scotch and had a drink, but I didn't even want to do that. I stretched out on the bed in my clothes, closed my eyes, and slept for 10 straight hours. Thursday, May 23, Rottenau. Father Lofra phoned at 8 in the morning and opened the conversation by telling me in a tone of mild reproof that it was midnight where he was. I didn't ask you to call, I snapped. There was a lengthy silence as he evidently decided that the wisest course was to say nothing to that.
When are you coming home? He finally asked.
I don't know. The police are holding my passport.
Why?
To keep me in Germany, obviously.
They don't have Adelie's killer?
As far as I know, they don't have a clue, much less a suspect. Believe me, I'm not in their confidence.
What have you told them about your mission there?
Not a goddamn thing. All they want to know is, did you have a fight with him? Were you carrying a gun? Did you shoot him? They don't have the slightest interest in my life story. Maybe they will someday, but not now.
Shall I get you a lawyer?
Not at this point. Aside from the fact that I found the body, they have no reason to think I had anything to do with his death. Father Lulfra chewed on all this for a while, then said with the comfortable certainty of someone 4,000 miles away,
"They can't keep you there indefinitely."
I'll explain that to them. What's the hurry?
No hurry. It's just that there's nothing more to do, so I assumed you'd be eager to get back home.
I wondered why he thought I needed to have this explained to me, but let it go. "I'll be in touch when I know more," I said.
"Do you need anything?"
I've got American Express and Visa Gold. How could I need anything?
Jared, you're beginning to alarm me.
This has not been a fun time.
It will soon be over,
Father Lulfra said. And we left it at that. After lunch, I went over to the theater, hoping Sheeran and Michael would be there. They were. So were Frau Hartmann, the American teenager Bonnie, and the titles. I wasn't expecting anyone to be particularly glad to see me, and no one was. Except for Sheeran, who was sitting in B's chair, everyone was in his or her usual place. Maybe they wanted at least that much continuity. No one was talking. I sat down and asked them what the prevailing theory was, who killed B and why. They looked at me blankly, except for Sheeran, who said, I wouldn't call it a theory. The prevailing feeling seems to be that B would still be alive if you hadn't come. I'm glad it hasn't reached the stage of being a theory. Michael said, why do you think he was killed? I don't know. The possibilities are too numerous, and I have no way of narrowing them down. Obviously, a lot of people were upset with what he was saying. This wasn't done by someone who just generally didn't like what B was saying. This was done by someone who knew B would be on that particular train. Someone who got on that particular train to kill him. Or someone who got on that particular train to kill whoever was available. If he got on that train to kill at random, why did he kill only B? I don't know. Maybe one victim was enough. Maybe no one else was handy the way B was handy. Bonnie said, what's your boss's name? The guy who sent you here? Father Lulfra. Maybe Father Lulfra had him killed. Why would he do that? Didn't he send you here to find out if he was the Antichrist? Well, just to keep it simple, suppose he did. Then what? Then maybe he decided B was the Antichrist. Well, he certainly couldn't have decided that on the basis of what he heard from me. And even if he had, he wouldn't have responded by having B murdered. You watch too much television, Bonnie. Father Lulfra is an archaeologist and a psychiatrist, not a mafia don. Bonnie smirked as if I were being incredibly naive or deliberately stupid. No one seemed to have anything else to say. Sitting there in the midst of all these silent people, I began to wonder if I'd interrupted a meeting of some kind, a meeting to which I'd not been invited. I decided this was something I had to know and was pondering how to phrase the question when a medley of footsteps sounded on the circular staircase from above. I looked around to see if newcomers were expected, but had the feeling they weren't. Everyone held tight until a troop of five finally emerged. They were assorted ages, teens to middle age, dressed in a ragtag style ranging from early hippie to late punk. They paused on the staircase to give us a good long look, as if we were museum specimens. Then, after passing a look back and forth among themselves, they clambered the rest of the way down and made their way through the jumble to where we were assembled.
Have we come right? Asked the leader, a bearded gent in his 40s. We are from Sweden, and we are told to go to the theater at Radena, and down in the basement, and there they are meeting.
As we continued to stare dumbly, he gave each of us in turn a smiling, hopeful look. Finally, still smiling, though now somewhat doubtfully, he said, which of you is the one they call B? Since no one else seemed inclined to, I took it upon myself to say, B is not here.
Oh, shut up, you stupid man, Sheeran said.
Then standing up and turning to the newcomers, she spoke three words that I instantly knew were going to rip my life to pieces.
I am B.